This is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio for the metropolitan New York area and the world. And this is the CPR Morning Show.
Arise, ye workers from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. That's right. For reason in revolt now thunder. Chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Away with all your superstition. Serve our masters. Arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition. And spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come on and rally. Then the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. No more deluded by reaction. On tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action. They'll break ranks and fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, each got the force must do their duty. And we'll strike while the iron is hot. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole beautiful human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. Ha! And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race.
This is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio for the metropolitan New York area and the world. From the metropolitan New York area to the world and beyond, wherever you may be. You're inside the CPR Morning Show with Don DeBarn. I am Don DeBarn. This Monday, the 15th day of June, 2015, half over already. We begin with a report of some of the news and events of the past 72 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special looking at the two-day summit of the European Union and the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, or CELAC. The region represented by CELAC, long treated by the U.S. as its backyard, is poised to be one of the major regions where competition between the U.S. and its EU allies and the BRICS countries, which includes Brazil and, of course, China, will take place over the coming years. Trade between the EU and CELAC stands at about $230 billion a year, while trade between China and CELAC currently stands at about $275 billion. That's expected to skyrocket in the next few years. This past January, China's President Xi Jinping set the goal for bilateral trade between the two at $500 billion a year within the next 10 years, which would move it into strong competition with the U.S. CELAC trade, currently at about $850 billion a year. China is investing more than $250 billion in the region over the next few years, much of it for infrastructure to support this jump in trade, including the transoceanic canal through Nicaragua and the transcontinental railroad that will link Peru's Pacific coast with Brazil's Atlantic ports. After the two-day summit involving senior officials from the 28-member EU and the 33-member CELAC group, EU Council President Donald Tusk, who co-chaired the summit with Ecuador's President Rafael Correa, serving as President of CELAC, spoke to the press.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. First, I invite President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, and Chair of the summit to take the floor.
Thank you very much, Treben. Good afternoon. We have just concluded our second EU CELAC summit. Let me first thank all the heads of state and government who attended. The high rate of participation from both sides of the Atlantic is a sign of the importance we attach to our partnership. And I also want to thank President Correa, who has co-chaired with me. Thank you very much, Rafael. I think it is a great sign of the vitality of this relationship that this summit was also accompanied by a number of parallel events organized and promoted by civil society, academics, business people, trade unions, youth and parliamentarians. This partnership is not just a political one. It is much more than that. The European Union and CELAC jointly account for one-third of the world's countries. Together we can have a decisive impact on, just to bring a few examples, the global climate talks, the post-2015 development agenda, and the fight against drugs. That is why we need to keep talking, keep getting closer together on the issues and aligning our approaches. This is why the European Union and the CELAC countries intend to take forward our political dialogue from here. From now on, we have decided that our foreign ministers will meet between summits to ensure swift follow-up of decisions made by leaders. And they will bring forward recommendations for how we deepen the relationship and how we can work together more substantively. To give you just one example, climate change matters to us both. Latin American and Caribbean countries are very vulnerable to this threat. That's one reason that the Paris talks later this year have to succeed and why the EU will continue providing support to the region through its Euroclimate program. We also discussed international and regional security. Chile and Colombia have already signed agreements with the EU to participate in crisis management operations, and we welcome other interest countries in the region to talk to us about this as well. The European Union supports the peace negotiations in Colombia and will back a future peace deal through the creation of an EU trust fund to support peace implementation. We are also supporting the process of modernization of in Cuba, which we hope will be reinforced when we finish talks on our political dialogue and cooperation agreement. I warmly welcome the steps towards full normalization of the relations between Cuba and the United States. The visa waiver agreements recently signed with five Caribbean states and just initialed with Colombia and Peru show our eagerness to bring our peoples closer together. After the entry into force of these agreements, more than 80% of citizens in the CELAC region will be able to enter the Schengen area without a visa. These openings are possible thanks to the good cooperation we have on security of documents and immigration. We will continue developing this in the weeks and months ahead. The CELAC region is very large and very diverse. For our partnership to be fully effective, we need to pay attention to sub-regional issues too. Today we will hold two high-level meetings, one with the heads of state and government of Central America and the other with the heads of state and government of the Caribbean countries. Finally, and importantly, just before the summit, we initialed an agreement that will transform the EU-LAC Foundation into an international body so that it can expand its work in promoting our partnership to our citizens. The EU will also continue its financial support to the foundation with 3 million euros over the next 2 years. Latin America and the Caribbean have become more prosperous and more confident, and CELAC embodies the region's ambition to achieve closer integration. This is something we have strongly supported from the very beginning. We can now confidently say, I am sure that President Correa agrees, that we are building a partnership of equals based on mutual benefit and mutual respect. The direct fiber optic cable that we agreed to build between our two continents is perhaps a simple but nonetheless strong symbol of our ever closer connection. Thank you.
Buenos días a todas y a todos. Bonjour.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Primero quisiera, en nombre de más de 600 millones de latinoamericanos y caribeños, agradecer profundamente a la Unión Europea por la organización de esta cumbre y al Reino de Bélgica por habernos recibido como siempre con tanto cariño. También felicitaciones por el éxito en organización y un agradecimiento a nuestros equipos de trabajo. La Unión Europea CELAC dio muchos esfuerzos para hacer una cumbre de 61 este estado
efforts to make sure that this summit of 61 heads of state has had the success that it has had.
Latina,
in meetings between the EU and Latin America, and then subsequently Latin America and the Caribbean, those meetings began
politico,
in 1999 with three areas, political and economic and cooperation.
Entonces,
and since that time, democracy,
de derecho,
human rights and the rule of law has consolidated in our region, and Europe has consolidated its union.
Introducción a este encuentro.
And as I said in my introduction to this summit, when I addressed the heads of state, we can learn from this example in Europe. We have different histories, different cultures, different languages, different religions, different political systems.
Soportaron dos terribles guerras mundiales.
But we know
muchos
that Europe has gone through two horrendous world wars, but
unirse.
With the political will in place,
cambio,
they've managed
Latina
to unite.
Todo.
However,
común,
in
común, común,
Latin America,
común,
we have everything in common, language, history,
no
culture,
perder,
and it's now
Europa
time we consolidate our union, and I think that
en este año
Europe offers us a great
cruciales.
Example. There are three crucial conferences ahead of us. The Development Financing Conference that will be held in Addis Ababa shortly. We have the post-2015 agenda meeting in New York in September, and we will be revising the Sustainable Development Goals. Many of the MDGs haven't been met, not even in part. We have to ensure there that progress is made, and then we have the summit on climate change that will be held in Paris at the end of this year. This is why this meeting was so opportune. It gives us an opportunity to make sure that we'll play a decisive role in the decisions that are to be taken for the future of our planet. Climate change, we only have one planet. We have to work together towards that. We all agreed with the proposal that in December in Paris we have to make sure we have a binding agreement, not just mere statements or declarations, but we have to legally binding agreement with contributions from all countries. We have to take care of the only planet that we have and combat the pandemic of climate change. It's not just a problem of poor countries.
Pero pronto,
it's not just a problem for island states, it's a problem for all of us. It is for the future of humanity. We also talked about migration. We know the serious problem that is being suffered at the moment in Europe, and we know that the lack of opportunities in the countries of origin, the significant economic differences that lie behind this. But we have to again here find global solutions. We're very open to dialogue and cooperation in that respect. And in particular, we talked about the new order of cooperation that is required by Latin America and the Caribbean. We are middle-income countries in the region, in CELAC. Before, cooperation was somewhat piecemeal. There was very much a distinction between the rural areas and urban areas. But what's key to development, ensuring welfare for all,
en promedio, América Latina y el Caribe,
in particular in the Latin American Caribbean countries, is human talent, science and technology. We talked a lot about all of that, about exchanges of teachers, support for universities, grant scholarships, but I think we also have to be more proactive to ensure that there is true substantive support for developing countries, that there be easier access to science and technology and no know-how that has been generated in the most developed countries, with, of course, compensation that has to be offset by something with innovation, because once we have created the technology, it has to be the service of the highest number of people possibly. We expressed our satisfaction with the fact that there's been a thawing in relations between Cuba and U.S. There has been a combat on the part of the Cuban people for decades for their sovereignty. We're very pleased that diplomatic ties have been restored between the two countries, but that's just the starting point. We have to remove this cruel, inhumane block embargo that has been imposed against Cuba that runs counter to the Inter-American Charter, etc. And we have to see the closure of the Guantanamo base. We know the absurd executive orders that have been issued by the U.S. saying that Venezuela is a serious threat to the internal security of America. Once again, they are acting in a legitimate legal fashion. It's unilateral sanctions, which of course break with the Inter-American Charter. We are also keen to see a solution to the conflict in Cuba, the longest conflict on our planet, in our continent, and we offer full support to President Santos in this very valiant initiative to find seek peace in Colombia. We would also like to express solidarity with Argentina in renegotiating the situation for the Falklands. We know that there have been contradictions expressed with regard to the sovereignty of a country, and we know there are very legitimate arguments that have also been put forward with regard to the vulture funds. The EU and CELAC are two regions which share fundamental principles, so the supremacy of international law, human rights, democracy, the right to all humanity to be able to live well in dignity. We are continuing to work on those principles, and we hope to continue this very much into the future. Thank you once again, President.
Thank you very much.
That was the President of Ecuador, Rafael Carrera, who is also the Acting President of CELAC. He was preceded by the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk. And now for more on the conference, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting live from Managua, Nicaragua. Let's jump right into it. Big news this week. We both agreed when we were chatting before the CELAC, the EU CELAC conference, and the context of that taking place. Well, the EU is wrangling with Greece.
Yeah, and I read the declaration a couple of times from the summit, and I haven't actually been reading all the speeches. Perhaps you'll be able to fill me in if I get anything slightly off key in terms of an appreciation of the meaning of the exchanges that took place during the summit.
I got it.
But the first thing I'd like to point out, Don, is that, and I don't know what you've seen in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Los Angeles Times, or any of the North American media, but in the English language European media, as far as they're concerned, there was no summit.
Yeah, I wanted to just do like a little teaser yesterday for the news, and you know, so I went looking at the Times and the Washington Post just for like a, you know, two paragraph that I could, you know, write a little reference to it about it, and they didn't have anything.
No. Likewise, the European English language media. I don't know about the other European language media, but certainly in the English language media I read, the summit was completely obliterated. Yeah. They just didn't report it.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Event. You know, this might be the most important event in, you know, I mean, the thing itself is only what it is. But with the convergence of forces at this particular moment between the EU and CELAC and Greece and in front of Spain looking at the election later this year, to me it's a remarkably, it's like a potential pivot point for history.
Well, yeah, yes and no.
Not intrinsically, just symbolically.
Yeah, my take was I was very much looking at details. For example, and I don't agree with the coverage that you'll see, for example, in Telesur and elsewhere,
yeah,
where they say that the summit came out with a strong declaration supporting the end of the embargo against Cuba and the lifting of the presidential finding that Venezuela constitutes a serious threat to the security of the United States.
Right.
And that is not the case when you read the declaration.
Right. Yeah. They in front of the cameras for the sound bites, they're compelled by the existing relation. They're compelled in any event by circumstances to make it sound very collegial. Like we heard one of the statements that came out of either Juncker or the other, Tusk, in talking about congratulating the United States and Cuba for helping to normalize their relations and all that crap. But they are very, you know, if the United States said tomorrow, shut it down with Cuba, they'd be like, oh, we did yesterday. So, I mean, everyone knows that, I think, particularly in Latin America.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that, you can see that there's a stark contrast between the declarations of leaders like Rafael Correa, the Cuban vice president, who made a, that really was historic, I think, that Cuba made a speech at that summit. I do agree that was a historic moment.
Yep.
But the actual nitty-gritty of what was agreed was very, very tame.
Right.
And very, very ambivalent. And so you get if you read the declaration, you get the European Union simply restating its long-held position that the United States legislation against Cuba violates international trading norms.
Right.
You know, and that's been their position for a long, long time. There's no change there. And what you get in Venezuela is that the declaration simply notes that the United States position vis-a-vis Venezuela may not be helpful.
Right.
You know, and that's right. You know, and if you and then that, but there are different levels to it, aren't there, Don?
Well, domestic politics. Let's look at, like, for example, in the EU. Again, given the current situation, I mean, Varoufakis spoke in front of pretty much all of Europe the other day. And I gave you my little critique before, but, you know, the essence of it was he gave this really interesting and unusual for public discussion in Western Europe and in the United States, I would say unprecedented here, detailing the nature of the crisis in Europe, not just in Greece, but in Europe's underlying crisis, how they got there, you know, the history leading up to it, some of the good, bad, and ugly. An analysis of where things are at and a proposal that he argued for. First, he laid out very clearly and he argued for. This happened in front of the whole of Europe. So if these guys came out with like a typical American written EU statement about it and, you know, demanding the imposition of neoliberal economic measures in CELAC and all that kind of crap, that wouldn't even play to their own constituents at home, because the political configuration in Europe is in flux right now, and potentially in much greater flux depending on a number of variables. And so they got to kind of, it almost sounded to me like a Democratic Party convention where they try to sound like the left while they're laying out the program of the right.
Yeah, you're referring to the European Union positions at the CELAC summit, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So. Yeah, but you have to. You and I have slightly different takes on Greece, don't we? Varoufakis is a Democrat, and he's a true Democrat,
right.
Somebody who believes in popular participation, listening to what the needs not just of the majority, but taking into account the interests of minorities as well. And he's that kind of true, genuine Democrat, not in the U.S. party political sense.
Right.
And what he's up against is the fact that the European Union is controlled by the elites.
It's an oligarchy.
And so when you can see, it's just so obvious, isn't it, that in what Germany and the others are doing to the people of Greece. So then when you shift that into an interregional exchange, what you've got are representatives of the European elites, whose natural allies are not the progressive governments of Latin America and the Caribbean. Their natural allies are the Venezuelan opposition, the Cuban opposition, the Argentinian opposition, the Brazilian opposition. Those are their natural allies. So then when you get this high-level diplomatic exchange, and I suppose, and it's ridiculously optimistic to think that you're going to get anything out of it beyond what it did in fact appear, which was this Brussels declaration from this CELAC, European Union summit, which is full of bromides, and that can be interpreted in all kinds of ways. And it was very interesting. And earlier, before we started talking about Greece, I was going to say that there are different levels and different aspects and different perspectives, aren't there? Because from the point of view of Argentina, for example, one thing that very much didn't appear was any mention of the Malvinas or any mention of colonial residual legacies like the Dutch Caribbean territories or the French Martinique and Guadeloupe and French Guyana, the French overseas territories. Never mind Puerto Rico.
Did anybody say reparations? Did anybody ask about reparations, for example? No, of course we understand
Of course
this.
Not. Yeah, right. But that's a sign of how limited and how kind of incomplete and impossible to complete that the summit was. It was a kind of mission impossible to actually have a serious talk about things, which is what Varoufakis was trying to do in his exposition. Now, if you listen to Varoufakis, I didn't listen to his presentation that you mentioned just now, but I've seen various of Varoufakis's expositions on the web, and what always strikes me is that he's talking about ALBA. He's talking about a progressive application of solidarity-based policies, whereby one nation, the strengths of one nation complement the weaknesses of another nation, and which is what the EU was originally supposed to be about, and that it's turned into a vast economic garrote that the elites apply to vulnerable peoples, like the people of Greece, or like the people of Ireland, or like the people of Portugal.
And it
just seems that what one might have hoped for from this summit was something like that, some kind of acknowledgement, some kind of sign of a shock between the ALBA solidarity-based model, which is very much the driving motor behind CELAC, ultimately, because it all derives from the decision by CELAC itself. In my opinion, and people might disagree, but I think it derives from the decision by Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez back in 2004 to promote ALBA and to promote regional integration and to not let ideology get in the way of the more important development, overall economic development of the region on behalf of the impoverished majority. That was their vision.
That's right. Yep. Listen, as somebody who spent a lot of time in conference rooms and boardrooms in right here in New York in the belly of the beast, to put it in simple terms, what Varoufakis was saying that he was drawing as a lesson from CELAC and from the other integration groupings in Latin America, hey, let's cut the crap and make some money together.
Right.
And he laid it out in detail how they could do it and how the plans they have were going to do nothing but hollow all of them out.
Right. And you can see that in the way, for example, one of the features, and going back to the different aspects and different perspectives, and let's set aside the ALBA perspective for a moment and look at the Mercosur perspective. And Mercosur is the common market of Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia, which is now a member of Mercosur and Venezuela too. Venezuela is also a member of Mercosur now. And Mercosur negotiating a one of these misnamed free trade agreements. They're not free trade agreements. They're investment, pro-corporate investment agreements that relieve transnational corporations and Western investors of all kinds of barriers and that otherwise protect the peoples of the countries with whom they're trying to negotiate this misnamed trade deal.
Right.
The Mercosur countries, it was very interesting. There seems to be a strong disagreement between Argentina and Brazil, because Dilma Rousseff said that she's anxious to close some kind of agreement with the EU quickly. And Argentina's Timmerman, the foreign secretary, said there was no way that they were going to rush into an agreement with the European Union. And then to top that, you got Evo Morales saying, if Mercosur signs any a free trade deal with the European Union, Bolivia will withdraw from Mercosur.
Right.
Now that is very, very, and that gives you, that presents another possible take on what is the meaning of this recent summit in Brussels.
Right.
And one of the possible meanings is that the EU is trying to Trojan horse its way into breaking up the kind of progressive regional integration that the ALBA countries are pushing for and that Argentina's pushing for, and perhaps to a lesser extent Brazil, in favor of an integration process that's more based on this spurious free trade, free market nonsense that has been so destructive in the United States and Europe. But even so, the elites still push it because it's good for them.
Right.
And they're trying to push that via their allies in the region, Peru, Colombia, Chile and Mexico, and to a lesser extent, Guatemala, Costa Rica and Panama. And that's another possible take on why the language of the declaration from this summit is so, in many ways, equivocal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. And that was a report of some of the news and events of the past 72 hours from the CPR newsroom, into which we'll be descending in a few hours to bring you an update of news and events from around the world and around the nation. Up at our website around 5 p.m. New York time, as always. Okay, this is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio for the metropolitan New York area and the world. Up next, we begin our daily tour of the American cultural, political, and social anthropologique. Today, we begin that tour with this.
I die each time. pretty señorita waiting for me down in old Mexico. And if you're ever in Alaska, stop and see my cute little Eskimo. Oh, my sweet Fraulein down in Berlin town makes my heart start to yearn. And my China doll down in old Hong Kong waits for my return. Pretty Polynesian baby over the sea, I remember the night when we walk in the sand of Waikiki and I held you oh so tight.
Yeah. time.
Sing a song, children.
To say, so I'll just live my life of dreams of yesterday.
Thank you.
their heart into black. This flower and my love hope never to come back. I could not foresee this thing happening to you. Ecstasy, you and me endlessly moving.
to help yourself. Look around you, all you see are sympathetic eyes. Stroll around the grounds until you feel at home. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Hiding in a hiding place where no one ever goes. Put it in your pantry with your cupcakes. It's a little secret, just the Robinsons are there. Most of all, you have to hide it from the kids. Coo-coo-coo-coo, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Turns his lonely eyes to you. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
a set of music from mostly, I think, maybe all from the 1960s. Let's take a look. Kathy's Clown by the Everly Brothers. I forget the date of that, actually. I don't have that written here. It might have been, actually, in the 50s, or else like 1960, 61. Traveling Man, Ricky Nelson, I think was 1961. Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You, 61, 62, maybe 63. Sukiyaki, which was a piece that was number one in 1963, the first Japanese language song, Sukiyaki Ue o Muite Aruko. By Q Sakamoto, who hit number one. It was stayed on for a few weeks on the charts in the U.S. 1963, beginning on this date, actually, in 1963, 52 years ago today. Chapel of Love by the Dixie Cups. I Can't Help Myself, Sugar Pie Honey Bun by the Four Tops. Rolling Stones, Paint It Black. Groovin' with the Rascals. Mrs. Robinson with Simon and Garfunkel. And the Beatles, Get Back. This is CPRMetro.org, Community Progressive Radio for the Metropolitan New York area and the world. From the Metropolitan New York area to the world and beyond, wherever you may be. You're inside the CPR Morning Show with Don DeBar, that's me. And we have today's date. It marked the first ever national defense, civil defense drill in the atomic age in the United States on this date in, actually yesterday's date on the 14th, in 1954. And just to give you a sample of the national mood, I think I'll go first to, let's see, what do we do with this first one? We had one on the drill itself, I think, right? And so I'm going to go to that first. Here we go. This is from the Federal Civil Defense Administration in 1954. Face it, from the Federal Civil Defense Administration. Produced by United States Air Force Lookout Mountain Laboratory, Air Photographic and Charting Service in Hollywood, California. Mushroom Cloud.
Let's face it. The threat of hydrogen bomb warfare is the greatest danger our nation has ever known. Enemy jet bombers carrying nuclear weapons can sweep over a variety of routes and drop bombs on any important target in the United States. The threat of this destruction has affected our way of life in every city, town, and village from coast to coast. These are the signs of the time. Only in practice now, a rehearsal, a training exercise. But tomorrow, this siren may mean the real thing. And if you hear it, as you drive in your auto, as you sit in your office, or work at your bench, wherever you are, what will you do? What will happen to you? Let's face it, your life, the fate of your community and the fate of your nation depends on what you do when enemy bombers head for our cities. And that is why civil defense was organized. To teach you how to survive in the thermonuclear age by taking shelter or by evacuating your area as directed. Civil defense will teach you how to take care of yourself, your family, and neighbors. How to get official instructions and act according to plan. In time of atomic attack, the usual professional services, police, fire, welfare, hospital, and ambulance, could be bombed out, too busy, or unable to get to you and your family. Civil defense control points would function as the nerve centers for dispatch of organized assistance to disaster areas from outside the target districts. Every preparation is being made to deal with emergency conditions which would be created by enemy attack. To provide for communication with the public during an actual attack, our broadcasting industry and the federal government developed CONELRAD. This system permits the broadcasting of official news and civil defense instructions without helping enemy navigators find our cities by following radio beams. The CONELRAD frequencies are 640 and 1240 on your standard radio dial. A hazard unique to nuclear warfare is radioactive fallout. Unseen, unheard, and odorless, this substance can only be detected with sensitive instruments. Special training is necessary for radiological safety experts. Their duties will be to check radiation levels in both damaged areas and probable fallout areas. When sufficient warning time can be obtained by early detection of approaching enemy aircraft, withdrawal from key target cities or fallout areas may be ordered by local civil defense authority. The instinct of survival is inherent in all of us. And national survival requires that each one of us assume his share of the responsibility. There is work to be done, and each must cooperate. Opportunities for training with the Red Cross and other groups are everywhere. The combined efforts of many trained individuals are needed to make civil defense a forceful reality. This training is invaluable in preparation for enemy attack or the savage fury of nature. Experience in past disasters has proved the value of advanced training and the need for more stockpiling of emergency food supplies, medicines, and other critical items to care for the injured and homeless. However, it was the awesome power of atomic energy as demonstrated in wartime use that brought to sharp focus the new problems concerning human survival and the urgent need for a civil defense program based on facts about the atomic bomb. Opportunities to gain this information came with the study of structures in controlled atomic tests conducted at Eniwetok Atoll in the Central Pacific. The main objective of testing is weapons development to strengthen national security. But also included are scientific experiments for the Atomic Energy Commission, military projects for the Air Force, Army, and Navy, and defense tests for the Federal Civil Defense Administration, primarily concerned with the effects of nuclear weapons on cities, industries, and people. The tremendous effects of heat and blast on modern structures raise important questions concerning their durability and safety. Likewise, the amount of damage done to our industrial potential will have a serious effect upon our ability to recover from an atomic attack. Transportation facilities are vital to a modern city. The nation's lifeblood could be cut if its traffic arteries were severed. These questions are of great interest not only to citizens in metropolitan centers, but also to those in rural areas who may be in a danger zone because of radioactive fallout from today's larger weapons. We could get many of the answers to these questions by constructing a complete city at our Nevada proving ground and then exploding a nuclear bomb over it. We could study the effects of damage over a wide area under all conditions and plan civil defense measures accordingly. But such a gigantic undertaking is not feasible. Instead, we build representative units of a test city with steel and stone and brick and mortar, with precision and skill, as though it were to last 1,000 years. But it's a weird, fantastic city, a creation right out of science fiction, a city like no other on the face of the earth. Homes, neat and clean and completely furnished, that will never be occupied. Bridges, massive girders of steel spanning the empty desert. Railway tracks that lead to nowhere, for this is the end of the line. But every element in these tests is carefully planned as to its design and location in the area. A variety of materials and building techniques are often represented in a single structure. Every brick, beam, and board will have its story to tell. When pieced together, these will give some of the answers and some of the information we need to survive in the nuclear age. At varying distances from ground zero, the point of detonation, numerous experimental elements are assembled. Underground structures and facilities of various types play their part in duplicating the complexity of the modern city. The vast research program includes testing such items as covering materials, paints, varnishes, plastics, also various fabrics and samples of clothing. On the outskirts of our test city, a synthetic forest has been erected to determine the protective value of foliage and trees. To give us a ringside view of the event, high-speed cameras stand like lonely sentinels, ready to photograph the hurricane of fury. Before leaving the test area, a final check is made on the multitude of instruments and technical devices which will record a variety of blast phenomena for future study. Now, with all the elements in place, our test city is complete. From the air, its center will appear as a bullseye to the bombardier at HR. On the morning of shot day, official and scientists gather at News Knob to await the momentous event. This is the payoff for months of planning and preparation on the part of the Atomic Energy Commission, the military services, civil defense, and other test agencies. As part of an experiment to observe the phenomenon of atomic detonation at close hand, military personnel and defense officials dig in within a few miles of ground zero. After a final briefing from the officer in charge just before H hour, the men disappear into their foxholes. Every precaution has been taken for their safety. They're told to crouch low, shield their eyes, and remain down until the signal to rise is given. Now the moment of greatest anxiety. Waiting those last few seconds. Wave reaches the trenches. As the tower of smoke and flame looms overhead, one thought is uppermost in all minds. Now it's over. The fury of it had stunned some, but not one was injured. High above, the smoke ring puffed by atomic breath rises skyward, watched by the men who had faced it. A scouting party takes the first look at the scattered wreckage of the test city. The imprint left by the hurricane of fire and blast remains here for us to read and analyze. From studies of ruins and damage such as this, we get the hard-to-come-by knowledge that helps us form rules for survival in modern warfare. While only atomic bombs are tested in Nevada, the results can be scaled for the larger, far more powerful thermonuclear weapons. A hydrogen bomb will destroy a greater area than the atomic bomb and will release more dangerous radioactive materials. But the problems of rescue caused by blast and fire along the periphery of damage remain the same. In these fringe areas, civil defense training can save many lives, lessen damage from secondary fires, and help establish emergency facilities. Now, in a helicopter, the radiological safety men measure the amount of radiation. When readings indicate safety for human beings, the troops are led in for a tour of the area. By double-checking with Geiger counters every inch of the route, men can now enter safely and confidently areas spotted with radiological contamination, an indication of the progress made in understanding atomic hazards. And thus, each test adds to our growing fund of knowledge. For it is only by investigating and experimenting that we get the facts to keep our military and civil defense program up to date and effective. Every bit of twisted steel makes its contribution. Blackened ruins and ashes of a structure add another chapter. The shattered wreckage of a dwelling offers an eloquent testimonial. Piece by piece, like the parts of a jigsaw puzzle, our story is assembled, analyzed, and evaluated. Then the survival facts are made available to you through your local civil defense program. In the thermonuclear age, civil defense, like military defense, must be flexible. It must develop and grow, even as the forces that threaten our existence. And so, until men of goodwill have turned this awesome power to peaceful uses, let us recognize the threat to our way of life, the threat to our survival, and let's face it.
That's your government at work. That was Project 95154 of the U.S. military. The Federal Civil Defense Administration, excuse me, 1964. The, you know, that really was, that's what we grew up in. That's what we grew up in, and they even had cartoons for us, you know, like this.
Dum dum, diddle dum dum, diddle dum dum, diddle dum dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and Bert the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do. He ducked and covered. And cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You and you
and you
and you. Duck and cover.
Be sure and remember what Bert the Turtle just did, friends, because every one of us must remember to do the same thing. That's what this film is all about. Duck and cover.
This is an official civil defense film produced in cooperation with the Federal Civil Defense Administration and in consultation with the Safety Commission of the National Education Association.
Produced by Archer Productions, Incorporated.
Yeah.
Hey, Bert, come on out and meet all these nice people.
But
it please?
Was, they played this in school.
Oh,
and
all right.
School.
We really can't blame you. You see, Bert is a very, very careful fellow. When there's danger, this is the way he keeps from being hurt. Sometimes it even saves his life. That's why these children are practicing to duck and cover just as you do in your school. We all know the atomic bomb is very dangerous. Since it may be used against us, we must get ready for it, just as we are ready for many other dangers that are around us all the time. Fire is a danger. It can burn whole buildings if someone is careless. But we are ready for fire. We have a fine fire department to put out the fire, and you have fire drills in your school so you know what to do. Automobiles can be dangerous, too. They sometimes cause bad accidents, but we are ready. We have safety rules that car drivers and people who are walking must obey. Now, we must be ready for a new danger, the atomic bomb. First, you have to know what happens when an atomic bomb explodes. You will know when it comes. We hope it never comes, but we must get ready. It looks something like this. There is a bright flash, brighter than the sun, brighter than anything you've ever seen. If you are not ready and did not know what to do, it could hurt you in different ways. It could knock you down hard or throw you against a tree or a wall.
Or vaporize
it is such
you.
A big explosion, it can smash in buildings and knock signboards over and break windows all over town.
Literally
but
turn you into a shadow of your former self.
Like Bert, you will be much safer. You know how bad sunburn can feel. The atomic bomb flash could burn you worse than a terrible sunburn, especially where you're not covered. Now, you and I don't have shells to crawl into like Bert the Turtle, so we have to cover up in our own way. First, you duck, and then you cover. And very tightly, you cover the back of your neck and your face. Duck and cover underneath a table or desk or anything else close by. In Betty's school, they are talking about the atomic bomb, too. Betty is asking her teacher, how can we tell when the atomic bomb may explode? and her teacher is explaining that there are two kinds of attack, with warning and without any warning. We think that most of the time we will be warned before the bomb explodes, so there will be time for us to get into our homes, schools, or some other safe place. Our civil defense workers and our men in uniform will do everything they can to warn us before enemy planes can bring a bomb near us. You may be in your schoolyard playing when the signal comes. That signal means to stop whatever you are doing and get to the nearest safe place fast. Always remember, the flash of an atomic bomb can come at any time, no matter where you may be. You might be out playing at home when the warning comes. Then be sure to get into the house fast, where your parents have fixed a safe place for you to go. Yeah. If you are not close to home when you hear the warning, go to the nearest safe cover. Know where you are to go, or ask an older person to help you. You know the places marked with the S sign? They're safe places to go when you hear the alarm. If there is a warning, you will hear it before the bomb explodes. But sometimes, and this is very, very important, sometimes the bomb might explode without any warning. Then the first thing we would know about it would be the flash. And that means duck and cover fast, wherever you are. There's no time to look around or wait. Be like Bert. When there is a flash, duck and cover, and do it fast.
You wonder why so many people in
our
generation
are so filled with
anxiety.
Here are some older boys showing what to do if the flash comes when you are not in the classroom.
You're looking for this flash like every waking minute.
This is what to do if you should be in a corridor. You duck and cover tight against the wall this way. Remember to keep your face and the back of your neck covered tightly. Try to fall away from windows or doors with glass in them. Then, if the glass breaks and flies through the air, it won't cut you. You might be eating your lunch when the flash comes. Duck and cover under the table. Then, if the explosion makes anything in the room fall down, it can't fall on you. Getting ready means we will all have to be able to take care of ourselves. The bomb might explode when there are no grown-ups near. Paul and Patty know this, and they're always ready to take care of themselves. Here they are on their way to school on a beautiful spring day. But no matter where they go or what they do, they always try to remember what to do if the atom bomb explodes right then. It's a bomb. Duck and cover. Paul and Patty know what to do. Paul covered the back of his head so that he wouldn't be burned, and Patty covered herself with the coat she was carrying. They knew how to duck and cover. They acted right away when the flash came. If they had been at this doorway when the bomb flashed, Paul and Patty would have ducked and covered this way, like this girl. Heavy doorways are a good place to duck and cover. She will be safer, too. Here's Tony going to his Cub Scout meeting. Tony knows the bomb can explode any time of the year, day or night. He is ready for it. Duck and cover. Attaboy, Tony. That flash means act fast. Tony knows that it helps to get to any kind of cover. This wall was close by, so that's where he ducked and covered. Tony knew what to do. Notice how he keeps from moving or from getting up and running? He stays down until he is sure the danger is over. The man helping Tony is a civil defense worker. His job is to help protect us when there is danger of the atomic bomb. We must obey the civil defense worker. We must know how to duck and cover in the school bus or in any other bus or streetcar. Duck and cover. Don't wait. Duck away from the windows fast. The glass may break and fly through the air and cut you. Sundays, holidays, vacation time, we must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover. This family knows what to do, just as your own family should. They know that even a thin cloth helps protect them. Even a newspaper can save you from a bad burn. But the most important thing of all is to duck and cover yourself, especially where your clothes do not cover you. No matter where we live, in the city or the country, we must be ready all the time for the atomic bomb. Duck and cover. That's the first thing to do. Duck and cover. The next important thing to do after that is to stay covered until the danger is over. Yes, we must all get ready now, so we know how to save ourselves if the atomic bomb ever explodes near us. If you do not know just what to do, ask your teacher when this film is over. Discuss what you could do in different places if a bomb explodes. Older people will help us, as they always do, but there might not be any grown-ups around when the bomb explodes. Then, you're on your own.
Remember what to do, friends. Now tell me right out loud. What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Bend over and kiss your ass goodbye.
Duck and cover. Duck.
This film was produced in cooperation with the public schools of Astoria. You know, that's what we grew up with. And on this date in 1954, this is when I was still in my crib. I was 2 months old and change. The entire nation went on one of those duck and cover exercises. And that was the first one. And, man, it was ridiculous. It was a hell of a way to grow up. This is, I think this is about that. This is a news story about the drill that day. And, let's see. Yeah, here we go. I think it's, here. They're in New York, Washington, and Chicago covering this national drill.
The Applejack alert. Enemy bombers, in theory, are approaching the world's greatest city. While the sirens wail their grim warning, hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers scurry for shelter against the attack. Auto traffic is halted. Riders and drivers taking cover in a realistic drill for a day all Americans pray will never come. A pall of restless silence cloaks the streets and skyscrapers of New York, one of the main targets of the mythical Air Armada of 400 planes. 8 million people vanished from view. A lonely vigil over a city paralyzed by atomic attack. Washington, too, takes part in the most realistic nationwide civil defense exercise since the atomic age was born at Hiroshima 9 years ago. President Eisenhower leads his staff to a bomb-proof underground shelter. Beneath the Capitol dome, streets are clear. Traffic is stopped, frozen fast until the all-clear that will breathe life into the nation's capital. Chicago joins in putting its air raid defenses to the test. Police flag down cars directing motorists to shelters. Across America, Canada, Hawaii, and Alaska, the story is the same. The sirens have sounded. A nation stands still.
Yeah, meanwhile, my behind is in a crib on an Air Force base in Utah. Like, ground zero. Yeah, it was the environment we grew up in, and it abated some at the end of the 60s, and Nixon and, well, it was pretty clear after Kennedy gave his speech in June of 1963, it's one of the ones we heard last week that are one of the two that many people think, myself included, were the speeches that got him shot a few months later. That it was changing. And then Nixon with detente and Ford further with that. We had like a really nice little run there for a while where some of those demons started to go to sleep. And then they started it all up again, Carter and Brzezinski and then Reagan. You know, we had the same nonsense going on again, except this time they didn't bother to tell us, you know, oh, by the way, you know, if you get in the basement and hide under a newspaper, you'll be okay, probably, for some of you, maybe. They didn't even bother with that. We all knew what it meant. And in case we didn't, they had a few nice little pieces on TV to show us. Fortunately, we didn't have that war then. Then the Soviet Union was no more. That broke up into the constituent nation states. And the U.S. made like everything was okay because the Communist Party wasn't in charge of those countries, that country anymore. But as they were telling us that, we were catching another breath. A, they were exciting us about terrorists, and B, they were moving eastward, so that now they are loading tanks into Poland and the Baltic states, and actually fighting a war in Ukraine. That's where we're at now. Now, for me, the situation looks a lot likelier to result in war than looking back in retrospect at the situation when we were raised with this than the condition was at that point in time. So I don't know about all you all, but you know. Oh, here's another little gem. This is from July 1956. This is the first that Connell read. This is Connell Rad Alert.
This is a Connell Rad Drill. Ladies and gentlemen, for the next 15 minutes, this program is the only program you will hear in this area. By order of the Federal Communications Commission, all standard radio and television stations in the United States are off the air in the first daytime test of the Connell Rad system of emergency broadcasting. This drill is being conducted in conjunction with Operation Alert 1956, the nationwide civil defense exercise. The frequency to which you are tuned at the present time is the one on which you will normally receive civil defense information in the event of a national emergency. Remember to keep your battery radio and your standard radio in good condition, so that in case of enemy attack, you can get vital civil defense information and instructions. The music for this period will be furnished by the United States Air Force Symphony Orchestra and the United States Air Force Band.
No Elvis, okay. That was 1956, and that stuff was airing when we were kids. This is from 1961. This is a drill attack message. This is what they would use. Again, we heard all this crap. This should come out of our radios and out of our TVs.
Your attention, please. This is Dick Chapman, one of your official civil defense broadcasters with a special message. Military authorities have advised us that an enemy attack by air is imminent. This is a red alert. You are advised to go to your nearest shelter area immediately. Find shelter. There is not time to leave the city. Your state civil defense director has just issued the following instructions. Please remain calm. Every precaution will be taken for your protection. Keep your radio tuned to this place on the dial throughout the alert period for information. Telephone service to your home may be cut off to permit military and civil defense authorities to carry out vital operations. Do not attempt to join your family or your children if they are now separated. They will be cared for where they are. Obey your civil defense warden and find shelter now. Take shelter in your basement or in your nearest shelter area. If you can plug in your radio in the basement, take it with you. Use a portable radio set if you have one. Otherwise, turn up the volume of your radio so that you can hear it in the basement. Keep calm. Don't lose your head. If you are at work, obey your civil defense authorities. Go quickly and calmly to your designated shelter. If your children are at school, they are being directed to shelter by their teachers. If you are in an automobile, pull over to the curb and then go immediately to the nearest shelter area. Do not leave your car where it will block traffic. This station will continue to stay on the air throughout the alert period to bring you authentic information and official instructions. Stay tuned to 640 or 1240 kilocycles on your radio for official information.
I wonder what kind of parking ticket you get for parking in the street during a nuclear attack.
This is your official civil defense broadcast.
In accordance with the authority vested in me, I hereby declare a civil defense emergency to exist in the state of Minnesota. This will put into effect emergency plans for your welfare. Minnesota civil defense organizations, including those of counties and municipalities, are directed to mobilize and act in accordance with approved plans. I am also calling a special session of both houses of the legislature to convene at a place and time I will designate in a later announcement. I ask that you cooperate with your civil defense officials. You will be advised of further developments by radio. Stay tuned for further information. This is Governor Elmer L. Anderson.
Yeah, from Minnesota. Now, that's an actual message that was produced to be played when, not if, but when the attack came. Something has to be said here. If you look at the actual records, to the extent that you can get your hands on any of them, of the strategic planners of the day, they didn't think that we were going to be attacked by the USSR. They thought we would be hit in retaliation. There was no scenario, really. I mean, there was a hypothetical scenario of a surprise attack, the first strike from the USSR, but nobody believed that scenario was based in reality because it wasn't in their interest to do it. The U.S., however, had first strike planning, and this, you know, defense against an attack, hiding under, you know, from an atomic bomb, maybe it won't see me under this newspaper. It's like a kid, you know, hiding under the covers. That was in anticipation of a retaliatory attack by the USSR. So the strategic planners in this country were doing this to us. And they were doing a lot of market research on us while they did it. So they were doing it knowingly. That's the population that's out there now. You're scratching your head saying, how the hell do they buy this crap and that crap? That's how. We are screwed up. Well, most of you all are anyway. Anyway, I'm kidding. Okay, this is in the spring of 1962. This is like 6 months before the Cuban Missile Crisis, when they started playing this stuff on TV every day because they thought it was going to happen. This was on TV like 6 months earlier. Now, you know, I'm 8 at this time. This is a simulation. It was on television. 1962, spring.
Good day, Dayton. This is your TV26 and Big Radio 1340 WIZE Midday News Update. I'm Dale
Kirby. All over the country.
This news update is brought to you by Reich's Department Stores. Well, President Kennedy has ordered the mobilization of the Hawaii-based 362nd Marine Heavy Helicopter Squadron. They will arrive today in southern Vietnam at Sok Trang in the Mekong Delta, just south of the capital of Saigon. Beginning on April 22nd, their mission will involve transporting Vietnamese troops into battle areas. In a recent press conference, when asked what he would do about American soldiers being killed in Vietnam, President Kennedy maintained that while we cannot desist in Vietnam, we are attempting to help South Vietnam maintain its independence from communist domination. In local news, the Wampler family of Trotwood, owners of the Wampler Ball Arena on Shiloh Springs Road, have just agreed to a deal expanding on their business. Their plans include instruction of a multi-purpose arena in addition to their already popular dance hall. Once completed, the new arena will hold over 5,000 people. Early planning has the arena scheduled for completion sometime in 1964. In international news, following the mid-March ceasefire, the electorate in France has held a referendum with a 91% majority approving the Avian Accords, effectively ending the Algerian War. French President Charles de Gaulle also wants to maintain French interests in Algeria, as well as give more rights to the European French community living there. The accords are now subject to a second referendum by the Algerians. With spring, a lady's fancy lightly turns to thoughts of the latest seasonal fashions, and you can take in those same fashions by Jane Derby, Pauline Treguer, and many more of the latest designs for spring at Reich's Department Store, downtown 3rd and Main, and all suburban locations.
Actual news headlines from the day.
Well, Frank Sinatra hosted the 35th Annual Academy Awards last night in California. The big winners included Lawrence of Arabia, which won 7 Oscars, including Best Picture. Gregory Peck won Best Actor for To Kill a Mockingbird. Anne Bancroft won Best Actress for The Miracle Worker, while her co-star, young Patty Duke, won for Best Supporting Actress, making 16-year-old Duke the youngest person to ever win an Academy Award. In sports, the Cincinnati Redlegs will be the first Major League Baseball team to visit the Los Angeles Dodgers in their newly christened Dodger Stadium. Bob Perkey will take the mound for Cincinnati in their second game of the new season, while Johnny Podres will be the starting pitcher for the Dodgers. The game will get underway this evening at 7:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Metro Dayton weather for this afternoon, mostly cloudy skies with a slight chance for a shower to the north, a high in the mid to upper 50s. For tonight, clear and cool, a low in the mid 30s. And then for tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sunshine with a high near 60. It's currently 52 in Springfield and 55 in Dayton. I'm Dale Kirby, and this has been your midday news update from Big Radio 1340 WIZE and TV 26. When a pair of advertisers hit it big recycling old Western films for television, their sponsor wants to make new films featuring the star. The only problem is no one has seen him for more than a decade. Fred McMurray and Dorothy McGuire star in Calloway Went That-A-Way, your mid-afternoon movie with Greg Baldwin, beginning later today at 4 on TV 26. You're watching TV 26, WSWO Television, serving Dayton and the entire Miami Valley from Springfield. It's 12 o'clock. The following program, Password, starring Alan Ludden, has been furnished by the CBS Television. Ladies and gentlemen, in compliance with security and civil defense measures set forth by the United States government, we are now activating the CONELRAD Emergency Alert System. This is an official CONELRAD radio emergency alert. This is not a test. In a few moments, normal broadcasting on this television station will cease for an indefinite period. If you are at home viewing this alert, we urge you to remain in your home, and if it can be helped at all, do not venture outdoors. If you are out and about, we strongly advise that you take shelter, whatever shelter you can, and keep a working portable radio nearby at all times to stay informed of any further developments. Civil defense information will be broadcast at regular 10-minute intervals in most areas at 640 kHz and 1240 kHz on your regular AM radio dial. All residents in the northern Miami Valley area, including Dayton proper, as well as the cities of Springfield, New Carlisle, Vandalia, Troy, and all points on or north of U.S. Route 35, will receive official defense information at 640 kHz on your AM dial, while residents in the southern Miami Valley area, including the cities of West Carrollton, Centerville, Miamisburg, Springboro, and all points south of U.S. Route 35, will receive information at 1,240 kHz on your AM dial. Repeating, this is not a test. This is an official CONELRAD radio emergency alert. Normal broadcasting on this television station will now be discontinued for an indefinite period. We advise you to again tune your radios to 640 on your AM dial if you are currently in the northern Miami Valley, or 1240 on your AM dial if you're currently in the southern Miami Valley, to remain apprised of any and all civil defense news or other information.
And that's the stuff they had going on in the spring of 62. Then they had the actual drills that they were anticipating. In 1962, in October, there would be a nuclear war breaking out over the situation in Cuba. And so they were drilling us for real. The grown-ups knew that this might actually be popping off, and we got a good sense of that. And it was it started to cool down. They went to war in Vietnam. I mean, you heard as early as the spring of 62, they were sending guys over there, all that stuff. And And then it was like in the late 70s that they started up again with that. Here's one from 65, but first. This is, 3 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
In any disaster, your livestock need protection, too. In case of nuclear attack, radiation is as dangerous to animals as it is to people. A good animal shelter is a two-story basement-type barn with a hay-filled loft.
Teach your cat a duck and cover.
You can get better protection by piling hay along the sides of the building. This gives more shielding, and shielding cuts the radiation danger. There are many more farm facilities that can be adapted to serve as some kind of shelter. For detailed information, get your free copy of Your Livestock Can Survive Fallout. In an emergency, shelter your livestock, then take shelter yourself.
You know, that's, there's more on this reel.
Right now, as you're watching this program, suppose you suddenly heard the wail of the alert. Would you know what to do? First, keep calm. Panic simply wastes valuable time. Gather all canned goods, blankets, and extra clothing. Don't forget a flashlight, a can opener, portable radio, and extra batteries. Fill all available bottles with water. Take everything to the shelter. If no shelter is available, go to a basement corner without windows. Stay inside your shelter until you're told it's safe to leave. You could have made things easier for yourself by preparing all these things before the emergency occurred.
Yeah, so you're supposed to start preparing for this nuclear war. There's a whole bunch more of those on this particular reel. But I'm going to try to find this because I saw... Then there was one that came out in 72. And... where the hell are we here? EBS false alarm. Here's a false alarm from 1971 from the emergency broadcasting system, which is what they called it after 65, I think.
5 before 10. Doesn't somebody want to be wanted? The Partridge Family. This station has interrupted its regular program at the request of the United States government to participate in the emergency broadcast system serving the Fort Wayne area. During this period, many radio stations will remain on the air, broadcasting news and official information for areas assigned to them. This station will remain on the air and will serve the Fort Wayne area. If you are not located in the Fort Wayne area, you should now tune your radio to other stations until you hear one which is broadcasting news and information for your area. You are listening to the emergency broadcast system serving the Fort Wayne area.
Studio, awaiting further information. WOWO received this emergency announcement just moments ago. We have to verify, we did verify, with a special message in code, and this is an emergency action directed by the emergency network and directed by the president. You've heard Bob Chase tell you that you are to tune to the emergency station in your area that is remaining on the air. WOWO will remain on the air here in the Fort Wayne area to broadcast any emergency information that is coming in. At this point, at the microphone, I know of nothing to cause this. We are waiting from Stuart Dan in the WOWO newsroom to bring us some information from any of our wire services.
This is February 20th, 1971. This happened at a few stations around the country, immediately. Nobody reports that.
We will bring you other emergency information the moment we receive it.
And at this time, I would personally like to urge all members of the WOWO news staff, any in the area and listening, to report to us immediately. We do not know the cause of this emergency notification, but we ask you to stay tuned. This is Bob Sievers. I'm checking the wires. I'll be with you the moment we have further information. We will cease all commercial messages at this time also. Again, ladies and gentlemen, we ask you, please, please do not call us to ask what is the matter. We are endeavoring to find out ourselves. We have received this official emergency action notification with the proper identification indicating a national emergency. We know nothing now. We are watching our wires. You probably will find that your own radio stations, unless they are so authorized, will be off the air. This includes the television stations. Now, please, if you are in your area and your radio station is still on, the chances are the emergency station for your area. WOWO is now broadcasting to its own immediate area, possibly with reduced power if you're getting our signal weaker. We are to be the information service for this area. This is Bob Sievers. I know of nothing yet. We received this emergency message about 10 minutes ago. We are continually watching our wire. I urge all WOWO newsmen to report to our station immediately to help us. And please do not call us to ask what is the matter. We do not know. We have received the official notification.
If this happened in a number of cities,
we invite you to stay tuned to this station,
and
other WOWO in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for information as it is received momentarily.
This was done to study us. And I assume.
Now, this information is just in. This information is just in. From the AP Wire, attention news directors and all bureaus, regarding the emergency broadcast message which was sent by the Air Force on this wire about 9:30 this morning, Eastern Standard Time, and I am quoting direct, being completely honest. It says, AT&T advises the AP that the Air Force at Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado put the wrong message on tape. But the wrong taped message. The normal tape explains the message is merely a test. This is the one that we always receive at this time on Saturday morning.
Right.
It says you will be further advised when additional information is available. And so, if you think this hasn't been something here at the studio, the Air Force evidently then at Cheyenne Mountain in Colorado put the wrong message tape on the wire.
This concludes operations under the emergency broadcast system.
Yeah, meanwhile, aren't those the same guys that send the instructions to the guys in the planes with the nuclear bombs? You know, a la Dr. Strangelove? Aren't they the ones that, you know, you got James Earl Jones decoding and Slim Pickens looking to jump on top of a nuclear penis and screw the hell out of some poor Russian city. Yeah. And so that's not bad enough. Yeah, I'm going to do this one first. This is 1983.
Okay, Bill Spinn's trying to get more than 100. And he gets 40, 90. You did it.
Dan Rather in New York. Against a Middle East and a Grenada backdrop, President Reagan is about to appear before reporters at the White House. On the Middle East, the president apparently will announce that former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld will be named as his new special Mideast envoy.
Nice, huh? Except that when they used to do that, the only time they would bust in like that usually was, you know, to make one of these kind of announcements. And we were on edge in 1983 with Reagan as president, trust me. But this one, I'm curious to see what this is. It's called Emergency Broadcast Prank on Mom. Now, remember, you got a generation of people like me out there, and you most likely, that grew up with all this crap, okay? So here we go. Somebody's kids. There's a picture of mom watching TV.
I mean, why?
Is that bad?
Yes. Yeah. Oh. It's true. The one there?
We interrupt our programming. This is a national emergency. Important instructions will follow.
Deborah, are you hearing the emergency?
These kids busted in on the TV. Their mom's watching, and they brought, they produced something, and this.
The request of the United States government. This is not a test. A massive launch of nuclear missiles has occurred from several nations across the globe. It is believed that many of the missiles came from North Korea, Russia, and Europe. Other countries may have been involved as well. Preliminary estimations are that 1,000 nuclear missiles were launched in total. Their exact track is unknown at this time. For this reason, our residents of the United States are strongly encouraged to establish a fallout shelter right now. Go to a location that has been approved as safe shelter, otherwise, an underground, and make sure there are no windows nearby. Protect yourself with many dense objects. Have a battery-powered radio for your stay in the shelter. Team the station serving your area for more information on the situation. The president will be speaking on all stations shortly. Stand by for this message.
Part of the basement?
Is my stack and bolt? Yeah.
Turn on your TV.
Notification. That broadcast.
Did you put that on?
With this emergency action notification message. This station has interrupted regular programming at the request of the White House to participate in the emergency alert system. During this emergency, most stations will remain on the air and provide news and information to the public in assigned areas. This is GMGH. We will continue to serve the Denver metropolitan area. If you are not in this local area, you should now tune to stations providing news and information for your local area. You are listening to the emergency alert system serving the Denver area. Do not use your telephones. The telephone lines should be kept open for emergency use.
It's too bad the audio is so lousy. This mother is scared to death because what these kids did, because that stuff is in there. It's in there. Meanwhile, we had a president who thought this stuff was hilarious himself. And here.
My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
Yeah, that was Ronald Reagan. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there was a response. This was the joke.
It was the joke heard around the world, the one by President Reagan about bombing the Soviet Union. And it resulted in a Soviet red alert, and it became a campaign issue in this country. Now, Marvin Kalb has learned that the Soviets responded in their own fashion.
The president was joking his way through an audio check on August 11th.
That I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
By August 14th, the story became world news, a major item on Moscow television where the joke was not treated as a laughing matter. August 15th, a coded message left Soviet military headquarters in Vladivostok. It said, in part, "We now embark on military action against the U.S. forces." The code was instantly broken by U.S. and Japanese intelligence. This is what then happened. A special command unit in Usurisk went on wartime alert. Key Japanese military units raised their readiness status. Soviet naval vessels in the North Pacific, baffled by the order, checked with Vladivostok. Confusion. U.S. intelligence urgently canvassed for signs of an imminent Soviet attack. Found none. Later, officials of the top-secret National Security Agency briefed Congressman Michael Barnes.
There was what they described as a wayward operator in the Soviet Far Eastern Command who sent out a message alerting Soviet forces in that area that a state of war existed between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Within 30 minutes, the mysterious Soviet alert was canceled. Was it unusual? Not according to U.S. officials.
They said it particularly happens on weekends when discipline is a little less than it might be on weekdays.
But August 15th was a weekday. One senator said the alert must have been a joke. A congressman said it was Russia's way of answering the president. Most officials said no comment. The one did speculate that the Russian might have been drunk. Marvin Kalb, NBC News, the State Department.
Yeah. Ha ha. You know, they're playing with our existence, you know, not for nothing. That I find that offensive. Meanwhile, let's jump ahead to today. They're moving, the U.S. military is moving tanks and all of the forward gear you need for an invasion up to the borders of Russia. Poland and the Baltic states are going to be taking these massive amounts of U.S. arms and some troops and putting them in place. We're going to go to this edition of Crosstalk with Peter Laveau, where he talks with Michael O'Hanlon, George Cimulli, and Martin McCauley about NATO versus Russia.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Laveau. Escalating rhetoric and the doubling down on failed policies. This is one way of viewing the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's opinion of the world, particularly Russia. Western sanctions and promises of more sanctions have achieved nothing. Is this why NATO deems Russia a military threat?
That's a good question, isn't it? This is CPRMetro.org. You're inside the CPR Morning Show with Don DeBar. We're inside Crosstalk from RT.
To Crosstalk NATO, I'm joined by my guest, Michael O'Hanlon in Washington. He is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. In New York, we have George Cimulli. He is a fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London Metropolitan University and author of the book Bombs for Peace. And in London, we cross to Martin McCauley. He is a specialist on international affairs at the University of London. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules. In fact, that means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much encourage it. George, if I can go to you first, before we started this recording, we were talking about Putin's interview with Italian media, and he said, and I'm going to paraphrase right here, that the thought of Russia attacking a NATO country is a person's nightmare, a bad dream. But when I look at Western media coverage of Russia, you get the impression that that's not a bad dream, that it seems to be in the cards. What is that based on?
Yes, absolutely right. NATO is largely a protection racket. I mean, it doesn't protect anyone. It's a protection racket. It sows chaos and disaster wherever it goes. I mean, it started really from the time of the first President George Bush, and in which he was trying to justify NATO's continued existence by saying, well, NATO addresses the issue of instability. And of course, what was instability? Instability is the non-existence of NATO. So it's a kind of a circular argument. NATO must go on existing in order to address the issue of the non-existence of NATO. And then it morphed into other crises that NATO had to address, which NATO itself largely created. I mean, the disaster in Yugoslavia was largely a NATO creation. And then, of course, Libya, its disastrous intervention in 2011, which led to the catastrophes in Mali. It led to the shipment of arms into Syria. And then the fueling of the war in Syria, and then of course it is absolutely idiotic policy in Ukraine, in which it is essentially corralling Ukraine, which is closely related in the history, culture, and everything to Russia, corralling it into essentially an anti-Russian military alliance. This was an absolute idiotic policy.
Okay, let me go to Michael here. Michael, I mean, let's say parenthetically, would Ukraine's membership, official membership in NATO, make NATO a stronger alliance and create a better and more secure Europe?
No, I don't agree with most of what George said, but I do agree with him that the idea of bringing Ukraine into NATO would be counterproductive. I think that's a fair summary of his point, and it certainly is a fair summary of my thinking. For one thing, NATO is not even considering offering Ukraine membership now because Ukraine's politics and policies are such a mess. But more to the point, it would be, obviously, an intensification of the problem with Russia. It would not solve the current crisis. I'm in favor of trying to create some kind of a new security architecture, or perhaps reinforce the OSCE
architecture for Central Europe and asking Moscow and NATO to essentially co-guarantee and co-stabilize this new zone and not have it be an area where NATO would extend, because I do not think NATO is an aggressive offensive military alliance, but I say that as an American. I know some Russians feel differently. At a minimum, they see it as a psychological threat and as not a friendly act. And I think we need a new concept for Central European security.
Okay. Well, Martin, if I can go to you. I mean, it's not just psychological. There are American boots on the ground in Ukraine. And it comes from a government that claims that Russia is escalating the military situation in Ukraine. I mean, that almost gets to the point of schizophrenia. I mean, who's escalating what? So it's not a phantom, and it's not an illusion that Moscow has and Russia has. I mean, they were promised. And I don't want to make this whole program about the broken promise of NATO expansion. But, you know, one can be very rational and be very suspicious of this military alliance that does officially see Russia as a military threat. Go ahead, Martin.
Well, NATO, really to be in existence and to continue to be in existence, has to identify an enemy. Mm-hmm. You have to have a target, and the target at present is Russia. Why is that? Because Russia targets NATO. Russia regards NATO as the enemy and is liable to attack. Therefore, you have the reverse, the mirror image of that. Now, NATO at present is in a very difficult position in Ukraine, because it can't really abandon Poroshenko, President Poroshenko.
Why?
Because they can
Why? It's because Ukraine is not a member of NATO. What obligations does NATO as a military alliance have to the state of Ukraine as it exists today? There are none. Zero.
They don't have an obligation according to the treaty. But if you look at Poland, if you look at Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and so on, they would say that if NATO abandons Ukraine, does that mean to say that if Russia applies pressure on us, that NATO will then walk away from that and say, no, Article 5 doesn't apply to us. In fact, it only applies really to the United States and perhaps Great Britain and so on. So therefore, again, it's psychological. You're trying to create an atmosphere. You're trying to create the impression that NATO is a strong alliance that is held together and so on, is looking at Ukraine. Ukraine has asked for aid. It's asked for help and so on. It's asked for troops on the ground. They're not going to get that. They've asked for membership of NATO. They're not going to get that, because a NATO country can only be admitted if there is no territorial dispute. And, of course, there is a territorial dispute. So the membership of NATO is not on the table. Poroshenko can talk about it. The Ukrainians can talk about it. But it's not real.
Okay, all right. What Poroshenko says and what other Ukrainians say is wag the dog, because they want the United States to come to its aid vis-a-vis NATO, which does not necessarily mean anyone's going to be safer. George, if I can go to you. Again, you know, I hear about the Baltic republics and I hear about Poland and all, and they feel so threatened here. No, they don't feel threatened. They just want somebody to pay for their way, because none of them pay their own way in NATO today. If I'm not mistaken, they don't even pay the 2% of GDP. So they just want the American taxpayer to pick up the tab so they can spend money on something else and fool the Americans, like this wonderful threat in the East. And you have, you know, NATO, they suck this up. This is their lifeblood. It's oxygen. My goodness, there is a reason for us to exist.
Yes, absolutely. There is no threat whatsoever to the Baltic republics and to Poland. And if they really genuinely felt threatened by Russia, then why would they be pursuing policies that antagonize the Russians? I mean, why would Poland be in the forefront of pushing Ukraine into NATO and into all the various European security structures? I mean, the crisis in Ukraine started with that EU association agreement. And the EU association agreement was absolutely explicit that Ukraine would be integrated within the common security and defense policy, which means in that whole kind of NATO-EU nexus. So Russia wasn't doing anything. Russia was not exerting any kind of pressure on Ukraine. Russia was not in any way threatening Poland and the Baltic republics. They were the ones who started antagonizing the Russians. I mean, Hungary doesn't feel any threatened by Russia. I mean, Czech Republic doesn't feel threatened by Russia. And then, you know, so the whole idea of bringing up history, oh, well, look what happened during the Cold War, or look what what happened under Stalin. I mean, you know, the Hungary could also say, well, look what happened under Stalin. But of course, it doesn't, because that was a different time. This is a different era. Russia is totally focused on its own domestic problems, and it has no aggressive intention. I mean, what would be the point? No one's even been able to present any rational explanation as to why Russia would want to threaten Poland.
Okay. Let me ask Michael that. I mean, because you go through Western media in just very cursory. You know, Russia is aggressive intentions, Russia's aggressive policies. What is aggressive about Russia's policy? The fact that Russian citizens go to the Donbass to fight to protect their families because they think it's the right thing to do? Is that a Kremlin official policy? And if it is, no one's ever proven it. Not one shred of evidence. Go ahead.
Well, I think there is quite a bit of evidence that Russia shipped a lot of weapons into eastern Ukraine, and I don't think it's worth debating that point.
I think it's important. Let's just debate. Well, you know, let's just get one thing clear here. You know, why doesn't, if that's just such a simple fact, why isn't there any photographic evidence of it? Is it because no one wants to compromise their sources? Well, these are important times, and the rhetoric that we have in Western media and coming from members of Congress, don't you think it's incumbent upon them to give concrete evidence to back up their claims? I think that's fair, don't you think?
Well, I think that's a fair point, except I think there is photographic evidence of a lot of Russian equipment in eastern Ukraine. I think some of it's been from social media, frankly. Maybe the government should make a clearer case so that we don't have to debate that point, and we can spend our time thinking about the solutions instead of the basic empirical evidence. So I would accept your point that a clearer presentation of the evidence might be helpful, but I think there is plenty of evidence. And Russian tanks in eastern Ukraine didn't get there by accident or because of volunteers.
Ukrainians just never had any tanks, huh? Really? Don't you know that a great deal of Russian military material at one time was made in Ukraine? I mean, you know, did you see a Lord of War? It all came from Ukraine, okay? So it's not a mystery that kind of equipment can be there, all right? I would be very satisfied if you could give the evidence of where these things came from, and then that would clear that up, and then that would make the terms and conditions of talking to each other a lot more clear, don't you think?
Well, I think that the amount of equipment in eastern Ukraine and the newness of the equipment in eastern Ukraine and who happens to be operating it becomes a pretty strong picture that shows that Russia is, in fact, supplying this equipment. But I actually think we're not going to make a lot of progress debating that set of empirical facts. I think we need to understand why Russia is doing this. And here I am trying to reach out halfway towards the Russian point of view. Let me go back to my earlier point. NATO does not have substantial military capabilities in the new member states. The United States has not based major ground or air capabilities in any of the new member states. So on that subject and on that military matter, I
Michael,
think
I'm going to jump in here. I'm going
to
interrupt you. I'm going
to
interrupt you. We're going
to
go to a break, and when we return from that break, we'll go right back to Michael. Stay with RT.
This is CPRMetro.org. Bernard West coming up at the top of the coming hour, so stick around for that. And we're back to Crosstalk with Peter LaVoe.
Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVoe. To remind you, we're discussing Russia and the North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
And this is the CPR Morning Show. I hope you know that.
Okay, I'd like to go back to Michael in Washington and jump in. We had to go to a break. Go ahead and finish your point.
Thank you, Peter. Well, my main point is that militarily speaking, I am going to again emphasize I do not think that NATO poses a threat to Russia. And by the way, I agree with most of your points that Russia has not historically posed a threat to NATO. We're in a crisis that doesn't have to happen. But I understand psychologically and politically why many Russians would find it offensive that NATO has come so close to its borders. And I would concede the point that if somehow the Warsaw Pact had won the Cold War and was now accepting Canada and Mexico as members, even if the purpose of that new Warsaw Pact was completely benign, we wouldn't like it. So on those points, psychologically, symbolically, and politically, I think we need a new mechanism for Central European security.
Okay.
That's where I come down.
I agree with you, but I do think we
need a new vehicle.
You've been on this program before, and you've said that, and we've been in agreement on that point here. But, George, if I can go to you, if you look historically from the time that President Putin has been in high politics, either as president or prime minister, I'm thinking of his first 8 years, he did propose exactly that. Mr. Medvedev, when he was president, he did propose exactly that in detail. And the door is always slammed shut. There's not even, well, we should talk about it. No, the door is just shut. Michael is a voice of reason on this program. That's why we have him on. We don't always agree. Go ahead, George.
Yes, exactly. It was slammed shut. Same with his proposals for a common ballistic missile defense system. It was immediately slammed shut. No, we're just going to go ahead with and build our own missile defense capabilities, again, in Poland, Romania, and so on. Yes, and in fact, NATO expansion is continuing. I mean, we've got now another three member states or three potential members being considered there, which is Bosnia, Macedonia, Montenegro. So just scooping up every country in Eastern Europe. Let me ask you,
those three countries, those potential, how are they going to make Europe a safer place? How are they going to make the world a safer place? Are they going to, what, send latrine duty to Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya? What?
Not in the slightest. Not in the slightest. And in fact, every single thing that NATO powers do make the world a much less safe place. I mean, look at Turkey. I mean, Turkey has basically been a belligerent in the war in Syria. I mean, it's basically been allowing Islamists to come in and fight in Syria. And how does NATO respond? It doesn't tell Turkey, hey, cut it out. You're making a disaster for Europe. No, it rushes in Patriot anti-missile systems and says, well, we are invoking Article 5 because Turkey is in mortal danger from Syria. So, this is NATO's position. I mean, its very expansion is causing the crises that NATO now professes to be addressing. The instability and insecurity is coming through NATO policies.
Okay. Martin here, one of the great debates in looking at the existence and the future of NATO is that there are many critics and maybe even supporters, depending on how you understand the argument, that NATO has to expand or really has to dismantle. It doesn't really have a middle ground.
Well, I think that one of the problems with NATO is that all the members must agree. You don't have one power dictating to the others. And this is one of the reasons why its policies are very difficult to understand at times. And quite a lot of what has been said is, in fact, correct. And bringing in Montenegro and Bosnia and Bosnia-Herzegovina and so on, in fact, is, if you like, enveloping Europe, Western Europe, the Balkans, in one security alliance. And they would then have a say and so on, and they would get money for the defense and so on. And they could rely on NATO if somebody attacked them and so on. But who would attack Montenegro? Would it be Greece or would it be Italy or somebody? No, of course not. So NATO has this problem looking at Europe and so on. Nobody in Europe, except perhaps in the Balkans, there might be a war in the Balkans. But outside that, there's going to be no war in Europe. There's going to be no war between the United States and Canada and so on. So you're looking at a situation where then you look around and say, where is the war going to come from? Where's the threat going to come from? And then you look east and you listen to the rhetoric of President Putin and Dmitry Rogozin and so on and so forth. And you say, right, we can identify an enemy now and perhaps we should get together. Now, this discussion has in fact been talking about the past all the time. We have to move on because there'll be no agreement whatsoever on the past. Other Russian weapons in eastern Ukraine, no agreement on that whatsoever. So we've got to move forward and say, right, the greater threat is Islamic State, IS. It's a much greater threat to Europe and to Russia and so on than the Russian-Ukrainian embroidence.
Okay, let me go to Michael.
Let's start talking about that.
I agree with you. We have to talk about the future here. Michael, if I can go to you, a lot of critics will say is that NATO exists. The United States wants NATO continue to exist because it's a foothold for the U.S. in Europe. It doesn't want Europe to have its own security architecture separate from the United States because the Cold War is over, okay? Okay, we're not fighting that battle anymore. But the U.S. is very hesitant, and to keep its stronghold there is to expand and to look for an enemy. It found its enemy. It's called Russia, and it works for American purposes. But does it expand and protect Europe's security interests? Because they are different.
Well, Yeah, interesting questions, Peter. First of all, having U.S. bases in Europe has been helpful for the Afghanistan mission. And by the way, as you know, that's a mission where we've benefited greatly from Russia's help. And it underscores a point that I think George was just making about some of the common enemies that we do have, that we should really be trying to get over this current crisis so we can unite and deal with these more serious threats to global stability. On your point about NATO versus European institutions, I think you're correct to say that many Americans are wary of things like a stronger military arm for the European Union. But the reason is largely because we don't see the Europeans very committed to maintaining military strength for any purpose, frankly. And we think they're going to spend more time deliberating over which organization needs to have a stronger headquarters and not as much focus on actual capabilities.
Michael,
so in Afghanistan,
that's a slippery slope. Isn't that a slippery slope?
Just to finish the last point. In Afghanistan, we've had to do 70% of the fighting because our European allies haven't really pulled up their fair share of the bargain.
So, and that's a slippery slope. When you know someone else is going to pick up the slack, you don't get yourself involved in it here. But the difference is here, Michael, is that you have Victoria Nuland, and you have Lindsey Graham, and you have McCainiacs out there, and they're talking a lot about NATO, what NATO should be doing, and is it always in Europe's interest? Because, as we both agree, they slack in their commitment. But at the same time, when they're slacking, other people make decisions for them. It's not a very good situation to have, particularly when Europe doesn't want to have a confrontation because of Ukraine.
Well, you're right. And the names that you just mentioned could be even more powerful and influential in the next American administration.
Oh, yeah.
So right now, Barack Obama, I realize Russians don't love Obama right now. I saw some data from the Pew poll yesterday that U.S. popularity right now in Russia is 15%. But nonetheless, Obama is a lot less inclined to arm the Ukrainian military or to do other such things than many of the Republicans running for president would if they were in the White House in 2017. So I think it's fairly important to resolve this crisis somehow in the next 12 to 15 months because things could get more intense before they get better a new American
George, president. I have a bad feeling it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better because a lot of the people that I trust in looking at what's going on in Ukraine is that Poroshenko will make another bid. He's going to ask for more American / NATO help, and this conflict is not going to be kept only in the East. It could move further west into Ukraine, and we will see that country's sovereignty could disintegrate. And is that what Europe wants? Is that going to help NATO's interest in on the continent? I doubt it.
No, exactly. Not in the slightest. Because clearly, what was the next event after Minsk II? America, Britain, Canada committed themselves to arming and training the Ukrainians. For what purpose? I mean, what purpose other than to launch yet another offensive? And there is only so much restraint that you can expect from the Russians. I mean, there will come a point at which they will get fed up because they have been very restrained. I mean, if you think of other countries, I mean, you think of American invasion of Grenada when their nationals were supposedly under threat. You think of India's invasion of East Pakistan in 71 because they thought the Bengalis were under threat, or Turkey's invasion of Cypress because they thought the Turkish Cypriots were under threat. Russia has been a model of restraint in comparison with these interventions. But there will come a point at which Russia will not go on being restrained when they see their nationals getting killed, bombed, massacred. And that will be a disaster for Europe. And really, who in Europe wants this?
Yeah.
It's absolutely insane. I mean,
let me go to Martin here because you bring up a very important point,
Thank you, George.
Because the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine are important to Russia and to Russians. In the newsroom where I work, there are people that have relatives in Crimea, in the Donbass. This is very close here. And so is it really worth it for NATO to keep poking Russia over a situation, well, I claim, and many other people claim, that the West started this mess in Ukraine at the start of this coup in February of last year. I mean, why should Russia and the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine pay for someone else's mistake? Because George is absolutely right. There might be a tipping point where the patience will come to an end, and then no one's a winner. Go ahead.
I would say that Russia basically has accepted that the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics will remain inside Ukraine. Crimea will remain part of the Russian Federation, but eastern Ukraine will stay within Ukraine. And I think they've accepted that. Putin's language,
yes.
you can infer
yes.
that. Now, from that point of view, he doesn't want to stoke up the war. And he wants it really to wind down. From an economic point of view, from Russia's economic point of view, they want this war wound down. They don't want it to continue. They don't want to provoke more American intervention and so on. So I would see Russia now in a position where you could talk to them and agree on some agreement.
Okay.
The agreement
on that point, gentlemen, that we've Eastern run Ukraine. Out of time. I'd like to end the program on a positive point, and we did. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
Yes, it does. Crosstalk rules. Thank you, Peter, and your guests. Yeah, so we're back where we were. Both at the early part of our program and at the early part of my life, anyway, and the lives of many of you, staring down the barrel of a nuclear gun yet again. Thanks to Washington. We got work to do. We got work to do, like I said. It's going to get ugly if we don't get busy. It's getting ugly. Okay, up next, we go to this edition of the program In Focus from Press TV, talking about Greece being between the EU and Russia, while all that other stuff plays out.
Return to Greece with the election of the left-wing Syriza party. But on the streets, little has changed. Some hospitals are running out of bandages, some even beds, asking patients to bring their own. On this week's In Focus, we're in Athens to find out how the Greeks are fighting back against Europe's economic diktats. And we find out how close they are to leaving the Eurozone.
I mean, we consider this as being a war rather than a monetary crisis. It's a war.
This is a week old, so some of this stuff is going to be week dated because things have been breaking quick. But yesterday, the meetings broke up between Greece and the EU. No agreement. And now people are talking realistically about a Brexit in Brussels and Berlin. Rather. And Bonn.
In early 2014, the Syriza party sent shockwaves across Europe, winning the Greek elections. They promised to end austerity and to be tough negotiating partners with the EU.
Εμείς είναι δεδομένο ότι θα τηρήσουμε τις δεσμεύσεις που απορρέουν από την συμμετοχή της χώρας, την ισότιμη συμμετοχή της στο ευρωπαϊκό θεσμικό πλαίσιο. Δεν θα τηρήσουμε δεσμεύσεις και υπογραφές που έχουν βάλει οι προηγούμενες κυβερνήσεις και δεν δεσμεύουν τη νέα ελληνική κυβέρνηση.
The victory gave Greeks hope that a new future was possible, ending the slide that has crippled the economy and blighted people's lives. So far on the streets of Athens, the scenes haven't changed.
Δεν έχουμε άσπρη μέρα, δεν έχουμε. Μαζεύω κουτάκια στον δρόμο. Δουλειά θέλουμε, δεν υπάρχει δουλειά. Γι' αυτό ερχόμαστε εδώ και είμαστε ευχαριστημένοι. Να είναι καλά τα παιδιά. Ο Θεός υγεία να την δίνει. Που μας βοηθάνε.
A soup kitchen. Many Greeks are responding to the crisis by helping others. Free food initiatives like this one are now all around Athens, catering for the homeless, those who have homes but still can't afford to eat, migrants, and often the newly unemployed. Many people here who've come to collect food won't speak to us on camera, embarrassed about the situation this crisis has left them in.
Ντροπή είναι, αλλά ντροπή για δουλειά δεν υπάρχει. Μια βοήθεια θέλουμε, να έχουμε δουλειά να είναι όλοι πόδι καλά. Τίποτε άλλο. Έλα εδώ, κύριε Κώστα.
Come here, Mr. Costas. He's the man who gives us food and takes care of us. God give us strength.
Αυτός είναι ο άνθρωπος που μας δαΐζει, που μας φροντίζει να είναι καλά. Ο Θεός δύναμη να το δώσει.
Just how bad is the situation in Greece now for most people?
After 7 years of crisis and recession and 5 years, let's say, of the restructuring austerity programs, in Greece the situation has turned really nasty, socially speaking. Okay, you have a third of the population almost without access to the healthcare system, and this amounts to also to has contributed to a bit about 20% of the Greek people not being able even to meet their basic food needs.
Walking through Athens, sometimes it looks like there is no crisis. The cafes are still full, the traffic a problem like in any major city. But you don't have to look too hard to see the signs of crisis. For rent signs and empty shops are everywhere.
If you see how many closed shops are around, especially in the center of Athens, and how darker, of course you cannot compare, but how darker the main streets of Athens have been after the crisis because of the shopping windows are dark, okay. It is, you can feel it in the atmosphere. It is kind of quite often, you know, you hear cases of young kids fade down during the classes.
A clinic set up by volunteers. Mary gives me a tour. Everything here has been donated. She tells me of one man, a German, who has been very generous.
Why does he do that? Do you think he's feeling guilty for what his
He's just feeling solidarity, not guilty. There are other people who should feel guilty and they don't.
Who are they?
Yeah.
Who are
You know them.
Yeah, we all know them. Oh, yeah.
People in Europe, they don't exactly know what we are facing here. They think it's a political matter, but it's not. It's a strongly humanitarian matter, and it's not only for us, because some of your countries will have to face the same thing sooner or later.
It's not hard to find anger, particularly towards the German government. Here, there is a perception that it is Germany which rules EU policy.
Do you not think it's strange that the Germans, the German government, are largely to blame for what's happening in Greece, but they send you this?
It was not sent from the government, it was sent from people. From people who know what's going on, and from people who know that we are not responsible for what's going on. We were blamed that Greeks are just lazy people, lying around under the sun, Syrtaki and Opa. It's not like that. We were very hard-working people. Some of us would have two or three jobs before the crisis. Now, we don't even have one. So, you can hardly blame the people for what's going on.
The public health system here in Greece is falling apart to the extent that some hospitals can't even afford medicine. Staff here tell me that one hospital nearby had to come here to restock on medicine because the government simply couldn't afford to restock the hospital itself. Some hospitals are running out of bandages, some even beds, asking patients to bring their own.
The money's going to pay interest.
The clinic gives out free medicine to those most in need.
And the Greek
they help
people
thousands,
didn't get the loans.
Most of whom have lost their jobs because of the crisis and now have no health insurance.
And what's your message to the European Union and Northern European governments?
What's your quote, Newland?
It's not a union, I can tell you that. It's not a union. I mean, somebody would expect them to be more... what are they doing? The Paris Greek people? What are they doing to us? They want us to be beggars or what? They have cut our pensions. I'm a pensioner. They have cut my pension 30-40%. I used to have a good job and I had an acceptable pension. Now I can hardly manage. So what do they want us to do? To be beggars, all of us?
While unemployment has shot up, so has long-term unemployment. In some areas, over 75% of people who are unemployed have been so for over a year. Many have little prospect of ever getting a job again.
I mean, we consider this as being a war rather than a monetary crisis. It's a war. Oh. Germany didn't manage to occupy Europe, and now they are occupying the Europe with economic pressure. That's what are they doing. That's what they're doing. I consider it to be a war.
Yanis Varoufakis, the Greek economy minister. He has become famous in Europe for his relaxed dress code and his confident anti-austerity message. He has also enraged European politicians for his combative style.
Εγώ το δηλώνω ευθαρσός, για να μην υπάρχει καμία αμφιβολία γι' αυτό. Ότι θα ήθελα πάρα πολύ να ζω στις Ηνωμένες Πολιτείες της Ευρώπης σήμερα.
I declare very today or tomorrow, or the day after, or in a year, I missed it. Sorry.
Unfortunately,
and on this we agree that the crisis is making unity between us harder. We see people and nations that are getting further apart from one another.
On the streets of Athens, Greeks give their support to Varoufakis.
It's May Day here on the streets of Athens, International Workers' Day, and thousands of people have taken to the streets to offer their support for the Greek government and also their anger towards austerity policies pushed on them by the European Union.
What exactly are you trying to say today?
It says no sacrifice for the debt and the euro. It means like people over profit.
Still new in power, Syriza is popular. They have promised to be tough with the EU and have given many Greeks hope. Banners supporting the new government are numerous.
So, Syriza is new in power. Are you happy with how they're doing?
I would prefer to be more hard on the negotiations and to have a plan to confront the European Union and the European leaders.
So most of the people here support Syriza?
Yes.
On the sidelines of the rally, we met up with the economist, Leonardis Vatikiotis.
The European Union presses Greece to adopt new austerity measures. All the negotiations of the last months is about one item. European institutions don't want to accept that on 25 of January, Greeks voted against austerity.
I asked him whether austerity and the policies of the European Union were helping to solve the crisis.
Austerity is working if you want to lower the salaries, if you want to increase the unemployment at 27% as has happened in Greece. Austerity works if you want to sell off all the public property, to sell off state enterprises. If you are German and you want to buy very cheap from Greece, yes, austerity works. But if you are a salaryman, if you are a pensioner, austerity not only doesn't work, austerity kills.
Why does it kill?
Suicides. If you see the last years in Greece, we had more than 5,000 suicides due to economic problems of the people. To close. Okay.
As we talked, some young anarchists in hoods came towards us, shouting at us to stop filming and threatening to break our camera. Luckily, there was a barred metal door in the way. The anarchist movement is big in Greece. They don't allow filming in areas they are strong. For one, they don't trust the media. We rushed a few streets away to finish the interview, hoping the anarchists wouldn't follow us.
On 2012, the European Union, the summits of European leaders decided to impose austerity forever. For this reason, I believe that Greece must exit from Eurozone. Greece, too, must exit from European Union, too.
But if Greece leaves, then there will be even bigger problems, no?
Of course, there will be problems, but the problems stake into the European Union are much bigger than leaving.
By a healthy majority, Greeks still want to stay in the Euro and the EU. They are scared about what could happen if they leave. Leonidas is one of many who believe that as long as Greece stays in the EU, no matter what government is in power, the Greeks will simply have to do whatever the EU wants.
Powers that be in Europe have decided that this government needs to be treated less leniently than others. It is my considered opinion that this is a political choice.
Across town, we heard about a more radical form of protest taking place.
Our organization is called I Don't Pay Movement. We are here because we have an activistic action today in this court of law where auctions are happening of houses. So we are here in order to block them.
And so why are they auctioning houses? What's the problem?
They are auctioning houses because there are people, many people, the vast majority of Greek people, who owe to banks. And in this way we try with a way of solidarity to protect their houses.
Across Greece, people who took loans from the banks to buy their houses are being forced to default on their debts, losing their homes. Many suicides are the end result. This action is just one of many that take place across the country on a daily basis.
What happens normally? What, if you weren't here, what would they be doing there?
The authorities come here, the lawyers that make the contracts of the auctions, and they beat the offers that come from the audience.
So the audience come here and buy people's houses?
The audience are some specific people that make this job. Right. They buy houses in very low prices from this procedure.
For businesses or individuals?
Yes, businesses, bank people, etc.
This group has stopped any house being auctioned here for the last 6 months. The new government has promised it will tackle the issue.
So do you have faith in the new government then, Syriza?
We have faith, but we are a little bit concerned because we see that the general environment, the European and in global scale, it's not very friendly. They want to impoverish Greek people.
Who do you blame?
We blame the 1% that keep the 99% of the wealth here in Greece and also abroad.
Then the police turned up, although not in any great hurry. They came up to see what was going on, but did not make any arrests or demand that the protesters leave. The new government is being kind to protesters. Syriza itself was born out of radical political action such as this.
Not what Obama
because
did to
very
occupy,
obvious
is it?
That the 1% it gets richer and richer even within the crisis, and the 99% is sunk even deeper, you know, to poverty, unemployment, wars, you know, etc.
In response to the lack of European help, Alexis Tsipras made a recent visit to Russia to meet with Vladimir Putin.
Greece is a sovereign country that over the past years
has
been facing a difficult economic situation. And because of the programs implemented in the past few years, it has lost much of its economic power. But it hasn't lost its geopolitical dynamism.
Russia has always been popular on the streets of Greece. In the past, because our anti-American sentiments were reflected in a pro-Russian stance. Nowadays, because the anti-German feelings are reflected in a pro-Russian stance.
The visit may have been popular in Greece, but it angered European politicians and further raised fears that Greece could leave the Eurozone.
What if Greece was to leave the EU and then try to be completely independent, deal with Russia, deal with China, deal with the... I mean, is that foreseeable? Could that happen? What would the EU do if they tried to do that?
Okay, let's be realistic. If Greece leaves the Eurozone and the EU, then it will be considered as a black hole at the center of southeastern Europe. Given the fact that we are in a region where many and different types of crises have emerged recently, given the migration flows, given the fact that in Libya we have a chaotic situation, given that in Syria and Iraq we have a civil war that creates more and more instability, do you honestly think that Greece will be a potentially useful or credible or valuable partner for Russia and or China in order to invest in us politically and economically? Not at all.
There seems to be few solutions for the Greek government. Stay in Europe and accept austerity, or leave and face uncertainty. In response, Greek people are looking for their own alternatives. Christos Giovannopoulos is a leading figure for Solidarity for All, an umbrella group which sponsors solidarity programs across the country.
Solidarity, it was, let's say, the social rooting of the political movement against the Troika in order to the position that we, that these people, struggling people, needed to face the consequences of the austerity in order to be able to stand up and stand up with dignity and stand up fighting.
At the Helenico Community Clinic, Mary tells me how she put out calls for items they need.
After we posted the request for milk and diapers, these are today's, 28.
Yeah.
So far, it's 11:30. And see how many persons they came already. We are working here personally 3.5 years from day zero. And I've never seen anything like that. I could not believe it. I could not believe it. That, there are so many people who want to help. even if they are facing their own problems.
This movement has exploded now, has it not? The solidarity movement.
Yeah, it's one of the main components of the Greek in the Greek society, you know, regarding the resistance movement, we could say.
Okay. Because that's in crises like these, you see a lot of horrible things happen, but you also see a lot of amazing things happen.
It is amazing. We could never believe the extent of the solidarity we would have from people, even from Australia. They send items even from Australia.
Mary tells me that her organization doesn't accept monetary donations, only required goods.
I mean, if I want to give you some money leaving here, why won't you accept that?
I told you, because it will tarnish our name. What? If somebody wants to harm our cause, it's very easy.
How?
To accuse us that we are accepting money or we're doing whatever. If we do not accept money, they have no grounds to accuse.
That no one's making money, you're not making money.
No, we are not making money. Yeah. Do not touch money.
Sure. Is money the reason this crisis started?
Of course. Of course it's money.
Back at the May Day rally, I ran into the Labour Minister and the new government.
Do you really have the power to say no to Europe and no to austerity? Do you have the power?
Putting an end to austerity has been our basic electoral commitment. That's why the Greek people gave us their vote and support. We cannot go back on our word. This is the ethical position. Imagine politicians saying that here. The most important issue is that the Greek people cannot put up with austerity anymore. Our people have been impoverished and our country has been humiliated.
Over the coming weeks, months, and most probably years, the Syriza-run government will be negotiating with the European Union. Whether they will be able to end austerity, however, is yet to be seen. To do it, they will have to have continued support from the Greek people.
And I think this is what is the importance of the Greek case, is that the people that they were chosen to be guinea pigs of the deepening of neoliberalism in order to overcome its crisis in Europe, resisted.
Across Greece, people are fighting against austerity. Whether it's taking to the streets, occupying court buildings, running soup kitchens, or working in community health clinics like Mary, many Greeks are fighting austerity and the policies of the European Union, whichever way they can.
So when's you're not taking up arms there, you're not fighting?
I fight it here.
How?
By helping my people. I think this is better than just going to a demonstration or whatever. This is a better fight here because it has better results. Unless the European so-called union, I don't call it union, decide to take some drastic measures that will affect the whole Europe, things are going to go from bad to worse.
For Greece or for everyone?
For everyone. For everyone, except Germany.
Which is never a good situation, is it? Last time things were going from bad to worse for everyone in Europe except Germany, there was a big mess to clean up and an awful lot of rubble and corpses, piles of corpses everywhere. So I'm hoping that they get past that. Greece is showing the way. Argentina went that way. Greece is doing it in the heart of Europe, or in any event, in the heart of the European Union, and that is a tough row to hoe. Well, we are at this point. And that happened. This is CPRMetro.org, community progressive radio for the metropolitan New York area and the world, from the metropolitan New York area to the world and beyond, wherever you may be. And inside the CPR Morning Show with Don DeBar, that's me. I think I'll leave the rest of that crap alone today. And we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of the CPR Morning Show, so be sure to check that out. Meanwhile, Bernard White is up next with Emanations. Be sure to check that out as well. And keep it right here at CPRmetro.org. Hey, hit us up with a few dollars, okay? We could really need a few bucks. I still owe April and May, and June is going to be due this coming week. So I'd like to get caught up, at least close to caught up, at least catch one, so we're only 1 month behind instead of two and then three. Please, we put a lot of work in here. We know all of you all are busy, too, and doing very good work, but we need your help, or we're going to be gone. We just can't pay this ourselves. So. Okay, thanks a lot. Bernard White up next with Emanations. Shift up the fire and hold. I heard screams and moans crying across the globe. In a car, struggle still, but not going close. Waiting for sweet chariots to come swing low. I'm with the million men marching. My party is real. The little too pretty, they trying to kill me like Maria. Demanding a balance because in SSB, I expose the devil like I work for weakness. Info, the rebel to revolt. Got the genius to unify. The underground nation now galvanized. People ask why such anger. I reply why the cops kill their Roy Henry. Same way that they catch your bell. What the hell are we supposed to do? When it's like against blue, rich against poor, them against us. Won't be no peace till we see just us. No justice, no peace. Take it to the street. Modern day MLK, turn the right cheek. They wanna hold press with violence, they protest. We get no rest and come with peaceful protest. No justice, no peace, take it to the street. Modern day MLK, turn the right cheek. They wanna hold press with violence, they protest. We get no rest and come with peaceful protest.
Can't you open your eyes and see the house is burnt? And we're in a hell of a condition because we've made a covenant with a government that is death itself, with a people that have lied to us, deceived us, and murdered us, and robbed us good on one side and kicks us in the behind on the other. You are a deceived people. This nation is not about poor people. Whether they're black, brown, red, yellow, or white, this nation is about rich people, privileged people, powerful people, and to hell with the weak, the poor. They must serve. If you don't have the testicular fortitude to say what needs to be said, then sit down and stop trying to say you speak for our people and the hurt of the poor.
Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable.
Inevitably. This is CPRmetro.org, Community Progressive Radio for the metropolitan New York area and the world. Bernard White's up next with Emanation, so keep it right here.